95.7 Ben FM presents Her Story with Kathy Romano.
Good morning and welcome to Her Story. I'm your host, Kathy Romano. Today's guest is a living victim of Ted Bundy. Kathy Kleiner was asleep in her Florida sorority house in 1978 when the notorious serial killer broke in and attacked her and a number of other women. She was one of three women who survived the brutal attack that night. Two of her sorority sisters were killed. She's here today to tell us her story. Kathy, thanks for joining me.
Yes, thank you for the invitation.
So I want to start by finding out where you are today, what life is like for you now.
Life for me now is great. I enjoy every day. I work at an art gallery in New Orleans, and I have two beautiful grandchildren, a beautiful son, and I'm married to my husband. We've been married 30 years.
Take us through the night of the attack, the night in 1978 that Ted Bundy broke into your sorority house at Florida State University.
The 14th of January, I went to a wedding at a little chapel I attended with several other students. We went to a wedding. It was beautiful and small and a reception, so I had a very good day that day. In the evening, I went back to the sorority house, and I changed clothes so that I was more comfortable and decided to stay in and do homework for the evening. I was on my bed studying, as well as Karen, my roommate, was on her bed studying too. Around 10:30, we went to bed that night. We turned off our lights, and we both went to sleep. At that point, I remember sometime in the early morning, I heard a noise in the bedroom, which actually was our bedroom door opening. I was asleep, facing, laying on my side, on my left side, so my face was facing in the out of the room. Our bedroom was rather small, like a dormitory. We had two twin beds that were parallel on the far walls. We had a little trunk between our beds, which was about 3 foot long. It held sweaters and things we didn't need at that time. On top of the trunk, we had books and other things we needed to be easy accessible in our room. When I heard the door open for just a few minutes, I woke up a little bit, and a few seconds later, I heard a louder noise, which was our trunk being tipped over and all the books falling off. I woke up at that point, and I looked into the dark room, and I saw a silhouette of a man who was standing next to me. He had dark clothes, a dark knit hat, long sleeves. I saw him just as he was raising his arm up into the air, which held, it looked like a log. I couldn't tell exactly. Just as he slammed it down on my face, the strike was very hard, and it felt more like a thud, a pressure. It didn't really hurt at first, but later on, I started hurting a lot. He struck me again on my face. Also at this time, Karen, my roommate, was waking up and making noise on her bed. The silhouette went over and attacked Karen as well, beat her with the piece of log, and when he heard that I was still alive, he came back to the other side of the room, which was like just feet away, wasn't a very big distance. He came over and started beating me again because Ted didn't leave any victims alive. So just as he was doing that, a bright light shone up into our bedroom. Our bedroom faced the back of the house, which is also where the parking lot was. A car was driving into the parking lot. Its headlights illuminated the room and really made it bright.
And your shades were open even though it was nighttime?
Yes, we had open. Our windows were rather long against the wall. We had our shades open because we hung plants on the rods. So we had beautiful plants hanging and our curtains wide open. When the car lights shone up into our room and illuminated it, it was very obvious to this person that he thought he was seen either by me or someone in the car. He, I guess, got spooked and ran out of the room really fast. And the bright lights continued to shine. And then as fast as the beating started, the beating stopped as he ran out of the room. And then the room was dark again.
And who was in that car?
It was a gentleman bringing home his date, Nita Neary. So she entered the back door by the parking lot and went around to go up the stairs in front of the hallway in the front of the sorority. We had a beautiful southern sorority. It was a beautiful home. We had big double doors that opened up. We also, as soon as she walked in, we had a beautiful wooden staircase that went upstairs to the landing on the second floor. It was only a two-story house. When this person ran down the stairs and out the front door, he did not know that Nita Neary, the sorority sister that was coming home that night, actually saw him from the side. She saw someone in a black outfit with a black knit top on his head carrying what she thought was an umbrella. So he was carrying the log out with him. At that point, she saw someone and thought it was someone's boyfriend up in the sorority.
And so then what happened? How did they then find you? Were you guys able to walk out of the room?
Nita walked up the staircase to the first landing. There was the bathroom right when you walked up. It had big doors and a beautiful wall with sconces on it. She went into the bathroom and said that she saw a guy leaving the sorority house to one of the girls that was in there, and they walked out of the bathroom together. Just at that time, Karen was walking out of our door. We were the second door, second bedroom, on the left side. When Karen walked out into the hallway, she was stumbling, and Nita and the other sorority sisters turned her around and walked her back into the bedroom. When they did, they turned on the light. They saw me sitting up in my bed, moaning and rocking, crying. In my head, I was screaming, help me, I hurt, help me, someone help me. But all I was doing was making small noises. When Ted attacked me, he actually shattered my jaw. I bit my tongue almost off, and he tore my cheek wide open. So it went from my mouth, my lips, almost to my ear.
Wow.
I sat up in my bed, and I put my hands to my face, because now it really hurt. Instead of a dull thud that it felt in the beginning, it was very sharp pain. I held my jaw, and I could feel the sticky, the blood on my hands, but I couldn't see what it was until the sorority sisters turned on the lights as they were returning Karen to her bed.
I can't believe you were conscious.
I was. I did not pass out during this time for some reason. I was just awake and knowing something was happening, but it was like a nightmare. I mean, all this was happening. I didn't understand. When the sorority sisters turned the light on, they saw the attack after it had happened. There was blood everywhere. There was blood on my walls, blood on the ceiling, blood all over the trunk on my side, as well as on Karen's side. There was blood everywhere on the walls. I remember my bedspread, my beautiful bedspread that I had just gotten a couple weeks before, was trees. It was white and green. That was just a mess. Everything was wet and sticky. At that point, the sorority sisters knew to call the police, and they dialed 911.
And what you soon found out was that other sorority sisters in the house had been killed.
Yes, it was a confusing time. When the paramedics actually came up into our room to tend to us, they came to my side of the bed, one of them did, was attending to my wounds, not knowing exactly how bad or where everything was hurt. He saw my cheek flapped open. I remember he said to me, we're going to take care of you. I was just moaning. He said, we're going to take care of you. You've been shot in the face, but you're going to be okay. At that point, I was really confused because I didn't understand. You've been shot in the face, and it just was more confusing than anything. when he stabled my condition as much as he could, he put me on the gurney for me to be carried out of the sorority, went down those beautiful wooden staircase and out the front door. And I remember being cold outside, just freezing, and they had a light blanket on me, but I remember laying on the gurney as they walked me out, and I was looking up at the sky, hurting really bad. And as I looked up, I saw heads looking down at me. There were police officers and the paramedic. Just all I saw was heads looking down. And it was a very frightening scene. It was weird, and I didn't know why these people were looking at me, and I was cold and I'm confused. And as the gurney was walking toward the ambulance, there were lights everywhere. There were the police lights, the fire truck lights, the ambulance lights, people talking. Just everything was so confusing. In my mind, I was thinking it was like a carnival. So I was put into the ambulance, at which time I was taken to Tallahassee Memorial Hospital.
And how long did you stay in the hospital?
I was in the hospital for about a week. They wired my jaw shut and took care of my shoulder, which was lacerated also. They put me into a room in the hospital. I had a single room, and at the front door of the room, there was a security guard posted. No one came into my room for a long while. I was bandaged now. My face was horribly bruised and swollen, as well as my eyes. And I remember I had just bandages wrapped all around my face. I was scared. I was really scared and alone. Finally, the officer allowed my parents to come into the room and my sister, which gave me a lot of security at that point. I wasn't alone, and I saw faces that I knew, and I felt more at ease at that point.
Of course.
So I was in the bedroom for about a week, and police were in there every day, all day, asking me questions, trying to figure out who this was. Did I know him? Had I seen him before? And it was very hard to answer their questions, more like yes and no, because of my wounds and my face being bandaged.
When did the fear fade away from your life?
I don't know that it really did until after I was in my parents' home in Miami. When I went back to an oral surgeon in Miami, he found that my jaw wasn't wired up and aligned correctly with my teeth. So after a couple weeks of being wired shut, he opened my jaw, had to re-break it from any healing that had been done.
Oh, my gosh.
Put two pins in my jaw, in the sockets by the ear, and my jaw was so shattered in my chin, he had to wrap it with wire to make it so that it would heal. I felt pretty safe when I was home because there was a security guard at our front door, and there was a police officer across the street in an unmarked car. At that point, I felt pretty safe. I was in my home. I was surrounded by family. I had police officers outside. So at this point, I was concentrating on healing and getting through exactly what had happened and reading the newspapers and watching television. It kind of put pieces together for me.
So what were the days, the weeks, the months to follow like for you?
As I recuperated, it took 9 weeks for my mouth to stay wired. And when they did unwire it, it was great because I could actually get some food in my mouth. While it was wired, any nourishment I got or any food was sucked through a straw, had to go through the spaces in my teeth while it was wired. When I was recuperating and wondering what had happened, I felt that I was going to be okay. I knew I was going to survive this, and I was going to be okay. I just had to get through it. While I was recuperating, I would go into the kitchen, and I would call on the phone Chi Omega Sorority. I would call, and only people that answered were the pledges, the new pledges, which was their job was to answer and take messages for the sisters. I would leave many messages asking for different sisters to call me. No one ever did. I never got a phone call from
Why?
Any of the sisters. Well, I found out a couple years later, one of the sorority sisters had passed away. She was my good friend from high school. She was one of the reasons I joined CAIO. Susie passed away. I went to her funeral. When I did, there were so many Chi Omega girls there that I was surprised. I didn't expect to see them because Susie was my friend from high school. When I did see them, they all came around me and hugged me and kept saying, "Oh, my God, we're so sorry. We never contacted you." And I pushed them away. And I said, when I needed you to tell me that life went on, that you were doing, you know, a toga party or you had another initiation or anything you were doing, when I needed to hear life was normal, you didn't call me. And I don't need you now. I said, I'm beyond you. I don't need you. Go away. They were telling me how they were forced and told not to contact me because as long as they did, Kathy Kleiner was tied to Ted Bundy, who attacked the girls at Chi Omega. As long as I was connected with Chi Omega, there weren't as many pledges that wanted to join Chi Omega because of that attack. Meanwhile, that meant that the corporation of Chi Omega was going to not have as much money coming in because of less pledges. That's the reason they were told not to contact me.
Wow, so they left you alone because of that.
Yeah, and I needed them so much because I wanted them to tell me it wasn't my fault, that everything was going to be okay, and that's what I needed, and that's what I didn't get. And that's why I was so perturbed and upset when they were there trying to cry over me and love on me, that I didn't need that anymore. I didn't need them. I was doing my life the way I wanted it, and it did not concern them, and it did not include them.
Mm. There were other survivors that night. Are they still alive, and do you stay in contact with them?
There were two survivors that night, one being my roommate Karen, who also lived in Tallahassee. The other girl was, her name was Nancy. She lived down the street in a duplex, a couple blocks from the sorority house. After Ted attacked us and ran out of the sorority house, he ran down the street, broke into the duplex, attacked Nancy, and left her when her roommates heard the noise going on and phoned her, which at that point, Bundy left that duplex thinking he had killed Nancy, leaving her just horribly beaten and messed up.
So do you stay in contact with her at all?
No, I don't. I never heard from her, and I never heard from Karen again. I don't know. I think we were in our little spaces where we were healing ourselves, and we needed that time. I didn't find it necessary to reach out, and I assume they didn't either since they didn't. I think it was a time of coping and understanding that we were going to be okay. It never occurred to me to call them. And then as time went on, I moved on with my life, and I was doing other things. And I guess the same thing with them. They were moving on, and as we did, the attack became further behind us.
Sure. When you testified at his trial, what was it like being in the courtroom and seeing him?
When I was to testify, we were brought into a big conference room before there were the paramedics that attended to me. There were a couple of the police officers that had been there that night, and they kept us separate from everything else because they didn't want my testimony to be influenced by anything else I heard. So therefore, I could not be in the courtroom while everyone else was. When they took me to the witness stand, I walked in very slowly. I looked around the room. I saw the prosecution on one table. And the table next to that was the defense, which had Ted Bundy sitting there with his elbows on the table and his head resting in his hands, and he was just staring at me, at which point I stared right back. I didn't want him to think he had any control over me anymore that I was okay and I was moving on, and he was not okay, that his form of being in control was taken away from him. And I wanted him to see me, and I wanted to see him and realize in my head that that's what was going on. So I was asked questions by the prosecution to understand what happened that night. Then the defense attorneys talked to me and asked me a couple questions. Their last question was, is this the man that attacked you that night in the Chi Omega sorority house? And I had to answer, I don't know, because I never saw his face. So I felt very, very sad that I could not contribute to him being caught and punished, but that's all I could say was I did not see his face.
But he was found guilty and he was sentenced. Were you in the courtroom for those events?
No, I was not. After my testimony, I left and my parents left. We didn't want to be in there anymore. My parents went, I think, to one other court session and didn't stay because it was just too hurtful for them to hear everything.
Being a parent myself, that was my next question. I wondered how your parents dealt with it. I mean, obviously, you went through the horrific attack, but being a parent, you never want to see your child go through something like that.
You're right. When I became a sister at the sorority house in the spring of 1977, I was allowed in the fall of 77, I was given the option to move into the sorority house or stay in a dormitory on campus. Well, my parents didn't want me in the dormitory to begin with. They felt it was not safe, that anyone could come into our rooms and, you know, anything bad could happen. So they made the decision that I should move into the sorority house in the fall of 77. At that point, in January of 78, when I was attacked, my parents, I can't imagine what my parents went through with knowing that they had put me in the sorority house to be safe, and then the worst thing that ever could happened. So we never talked about it. I didn't want to bring it up, and they were in their own turmoil and their own heads on what they had done and felt responsible for me being there. After I was attacked and living with them, they were so tender with me and so protective and just loving on me. And since we never talked about it, I didn't feel their pain as much as what they were going through. All I knew was that my family was around me and I was in my safe cocoon of being taken care of.
And they probably did that on purpose to protect you.
Yes. They actually, when the news was on television and the newspapers, they tended to put soap operas on the TV.
Aww.
So that I would not watch as much of the coverage that was actually happening through Tallahassee and all the coverage that was going on. So I watched a lot of soap operas during that time.
Where were you when Ted Bundy was executed?
I lived in Boca Raton, Florida. I had a son. I was a single parent for about 8 years after I divorced his father. I had sent Mikey over to my parents' house, who also lived in Boca Raton. So he wasn't with me, and I didn't know what I would be doing and everything. So when we got the message that Ted had actually been executed, I was sitting on the sofa with Scott, and I remember just breaking down and crying and just felt for Lisa and Margaret, my two sorority sisters that were killed, and for all the other women that Ted Bundy had taken away from us and killed and mutilated and everything ugly that he did. I just cried it out. After a while, I composed myself. I felt better, and I told Scott, I'm hungry. Let's go get breakfast. And that was the first day of my true healing.
And Scott is who eventually became your husband.
Yes, he was.
In the years to follow, you actually read a lot of books about serial killers and about Ted Bundy himself. Is that correct?
Yes, it was. As soon as I could, I found anything that was written about them, any journal stories in the paper. I remember my first book was The Stranger Beside Me by Anne Rule, which I found very beneficial to me because I wanted to understand Ted as a person, what made him tick, who he was, how he was the monster. And that seemed to help me heal because it wasn't this big, scary person, this thing. It was an actual person. He was sick. He had so many things he was dealing with in his own psyche and his own mind that helped me heal, too, because I knew I didn't do anything wrong, that he's the one that came in and attacked me.
Kathy, before you go, if you could give one bit of advice to our listeners today, what would it be?
I think that anyone who's been through trauma, anyone that has gone through a traumatic experience or violence, I think they have to know that in order to heal themselves, they need to find the strength that's in them. I think everyone's born with a strength, and they just have to dig deep inside of them and pull it out and learn to lean on that strength, because once they have it, no one can take it away from them. And that strength is going to help them get through this by finding a little dream, a little something to work for and to live for. Once you make that achievement, once you make that little dream, if it's going to the store or if it's buying something they've always wanted, that little dream becomes true, then they can set their sights on a bigger dream. And by dreaming, we live because there's things to live for.
Well, Kathy, hearing your story and hearing how you survived that traumatic event and were able to heal yourself and live a happy life is very inspirational. And I really thank you for calling in today and talking to me.
Thank you. And I appreciate you allowing me. And I just wanted to thank you for the opportunity. And to tell you the truth, every time I talk to people, it still heals me because I'm taking steps away from that night. And anytime I can do that, I feel stronger. So I appreciate you allowing me to tell my story, and it helps me as well.
Well, good. I'm glad, Kathy, and thank you so much for calling in.
You're welcome.
If you didn't catch all of my interview with Kathy Kleiner, who is a Ted Bundy survivor, it will be available for podcast on 957benfm.com on Monday morning. Thanks so much for joining me today. I'm Kathy Romano. Enjoy the rest of your Sunday.
This has been Her Story with Kathy Romano. Her Story is produced by WBEN-FM in Philadelphia and airs weekly or on demand on your mobile device. Listen or subscribe at 957benfm.com.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Like most of us, Keith Urban also has a bucket list. You may be surprised to learn what is and is not on his. Text Keith to 45911 to read and learn more about the central theme of Keith's bucket list. Get a link to the story sent right to your phone when you text Keith to 45911. Go inside country music at BackstageCountry.com.